Hey guys, this is Joel, and you're watching my podcast, Party Like a Rockstar. If you haven't watched any of the episodes yet, it's cool. My background is I was a roadie for bands like Guns N' Roses, Stone Temple Pilots, The Cranberries, and Poison. I wrote a book called Memoir of a Roadie. It was the number one new release on Amazon and Bios, and it's done 3 million copies on Kindle. It's been a lot of fun. This episode's a cool one. I got a couple drummers for you. The first one is my old buddy Ryan Hoyle. Been friends with him a really long time. Ryan was the drummer for Paul Rodgers from Bad Company and also the drummer of Collective Soul from 2005 to 2008. Ryan's actually now running his own studio where you can go record with Ryan. Kind of a no-brainer if you're interested in making music. If you want to get a hold of him, go to livedrumtracks.com and Ryan himself will answer you. My second guest is his buddy, Jason Sutter. Jason Sutter is also a well-known drummer. He's worked for Marilyn Manson, Smash Mouth, the New York Dolls, Chris Cornell, Joe Perry, Foreigner, Ben Lee, Vertical Horizon, the Rembrandts, Joel Walsh, and Robert and Dean DeLeo. Before I even started the interview, we talked for, well, a little while. Maybe a long while. But I pulled two excerpts from that talk that I think you guys will dig. Check them out. It's Basquiat, right?
Yeah, it's actually, it's from a record cover from one of the, he only did two record covers, and that's actually a band called The Offs.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a really rare Basquiat. I know a dude who, you know, basically that camp is really tight, you know, his family is really tight with releasing prints, and a guy bought the record label, the punk New York record label that owned that record that came out in 1984 was some like, it's actually a good record. The record sold for like thousands of dollars. And that dude died of heroin, the singer of The Offs, like 3 months after the record came out. But Basquiat was a huge fan and did the record. And this guy got the rights to be able to release a limited amount of prints because he bought the actual record label. And with that came the rights to the art, which is super rare. So I knew the guy, he was in Venice. And he printed 80 of these, and they actually sell at museums with his retrospect right now, this show. So
cool.
Random, but rock and roll. You know, I actually, the couch over here was a housewarming gift from Robert DeLeo.
Oh, dude, that's cool.
Yeah, it was an
old. Oh, that's right. I was going to ask you about it. You played with Robert.
I work with Robert and Dean. I just played on Dean's new record, actually, which is a really cool record. But those guys, I ended up, when they went into they ventured into like producing bands. I was in the band that was on Maverick and they produced our record and we became really close and they were just getting really busy to producing. And they said, we're going to need a drummer because then they can come in and like, you know, they could come in and work with like Peter Frampton or Joe Walsh. And even if it was just writing, they wanted to be able to be like a package and they needed a drummer. So they said, hey, we dig you and your style. Will you be our drummer guy for our production shit? So I got to work with Joe Walsh and Peter Frampton, but they basically became like, you know, they're, I don't know how your reaction to those two, but those brothers to me are like the coolest fucking dudes. I mean, they should have a podcast.
No.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I went to see Cheap Trick in Ventura. At the Ventura Fair, and I ran into Dean like a couple months ago. It was pretty cute.
He's a good dude. He's such a good guitar player too. But I would tell people,
oh yeah,
every STP song is a Zeppelin song, and if he's in the mood, he'll sit there and start playing Zeppelin, and totally transition into STP the same. And it's such a neat thing to see as he does it because he looks at you and he'll smile.
People forget, and Robert, Dean will say, Robert's a better guitarist than Dean is. You know, Dean will say, Robert's better than I am. He taught me what I know. And he's come over and he'll literally, you can put on like Hemispheres, and he'll pick up an acoustic guitar and play every fucking note on Rush Hemispheres. Absolutely.
So his very first concert when he was a kid was Rush.
Robert. I believe it.
Yeah, very.
No, I remember Robert telling me a story that Dean had tickets to see Kiss at Madison Square Garden in like 77 or something. And he went out late and got in trouble, came home drunk and got in trouble. And so he had to give Robert his ticket and Robert got to go see Kiss. And years later, He was like the young kid who went with Dean, because Dean's like 10 years older than Robert, or 8 years older. So he went with the older dude. So there was a little Robert, and they got to see Kiss. And years later, when they were playing Madison Square Garden, the same two dudes were there, and that he went with. And like, you know, we're like, hey, dude, remember we saw Kiss? They like yelled out like from the side, you know. It was like pretty fucking cool. Classic.
There you go. Those were the excerpts. Hopefully a bit of fun. Let's get into the interview. My first question is going to be here to Ryan. And my question is going to be, would you ever be seen dead in a drumline?
That's a funny question. I actually did audition for the drumline in high school. And they put me in the pit. So I never got to march at all. I just watched them while I practiced rudiments kind of on the grass on the side, you know, the fake grass.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I got a win there because they were dancing around and doing choreography and I got to practice rudiments. So would I ever be caught dead in a drum line? I don't know. If I was dead, I wouldn't be able to march. So it's a trick question.
Deep thinking. Yeah. So it's really pretty.
Now, Jason's big drum line, right?
He said he had been in drum line. So I was like,
I didn't try, man. It happened by accident. I came from upstate New York near the Adirondack Mountains. I put on a drum once a year to play Yankee Doodle Dandy around our like tiny little town. It was a college town in Potsdam, New York. So I would once a year I would march around. So I had no idea about marking time. I had no idea. I had good rudimental hands, which, you know, Ryan does as well, but I didn't have that at all. I went literally from that to University of North Texas, which Ryan also attended, which is like arguably any drumline now, the blueprint was North Texas. Okay. In the early 80s.
Eddie told me though that you'd Miami.
I ended up going to North Texas, playing every instrument in the drumline from cymbals to snare drum. And then from there, I ended up getting an assistantship at University of Miami, like the Canes. Rohan Marley was one of the, like, you know, linebackers. It was back when Miami was like the golden era. This is 1992. And yeah. My assistantship was to run the like 40 piece University of Miami Hurricane drumline. And that was, so I went from like literally not knowing how to do this shit at all to like literally being the instructor for 2 years and getting paid to go to University of Miami in the sports department. So my joke is that I have a football scholarship because basically I never missed, same at North Texas. I had a scholarship in North Texas. I never missed a football game. So I never need to see another football game for as long as I, you know.
Yeah, what Eddie said was unique about you is he said that you knew tuning like so well. And he's like, it's actually crazy. Most drummers suck at tuning. And he goes, Jason is so good.
Interesting. So I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed. You know.
Yeah,
I'm
me
obsessed
too.
With it. You are?
Ryan is definitely way more obsessive than I. Ryan's into like wing nuts on cymbals for the vibration, or like, you know, like the brass rims or like shit that they're way, you're the dude.
They don't care about that crap in Texas, Ryan. You're going to have to switch up.
Yeah. I know, but I do have a little drumline comment that's kind of a job drop.
Oh, yeah, we got.
Well, I've been working on that show Stranger Things, and so they hired me for season 4 to recreate all their high school drumline parts.
Okay.
For the show. And I don't have any of the equipment. I don't have tenor drums and marching snare drums and things. So I was just trying to kind of like make it work. And I remember at one point, Sutter, you reminded me of this when you said you played cymbals. I took like 2 20-inch crash cymbals and I'm trying to do this like part where psh, 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 with muting and everything. And I didn't have the handles. I didn't have any. I don't know where I put the little leather handles. So I grabbed 2 hi-hat clutches.
Nice.
And I'm grabbing them like this, and I'm trying to do this. And so the producer's my engineer's on the talk back, and he goes, dude, can you do that again? And I'm like, I think I'm bleeding. And he goes, well, let's just stop there. Let's stop there. I'm like, my hands are totally bleeding. And so you reminded me of that.
That's funny. Yeah. No, I mean, I never intended to do anything. So it's funny that you're mentioning the drumline, Dave, but maybe you're kind of connecting the dots. But yeah, it's a pretty bizarre little world, but I've literally gone so far away from that, but it is wild sometimes when I remember, oh shit, I'm like a specialist, or was a specialist back in the day in that. And I don't go near it at all, but yeah, it was a wild time, but it's
the other
fascinating.
One that I was totally intrigued by was Bonzo Bash. And he was telling me, it sounded like straight mayhem. So how long did you do that for?
Well, I did like seven of them. And the coolest thing about that was, Brian Tichy, I think, brought that, and the coolest thing about that, I think, is that you got to see there was one drum set. Well, you didn't change the cymbals, you didn't change the tuning. You literally had a minute to get up and play one song. The band was the same. So it was kind of fascinating to watch Chad Smith or Abe Laboriel Jr. or me or Tishy and different dudes get up and play on this one kit. It was really fascinating, kind of experiment to see how much different everyone sounded and how different that drum set sounded from guy to guy. So that was cool. The other cool thing about that for me is suddenly I'm playing in this venue with, and I had a couple gigs under my belt, but I was not, I'm playing. Chad Smith is here, and the
He
list
told me,
goes
he
on and
said what he would
on.
have to do for you. He's like, dude, I would start breaking down the drum kit while Jason was still playing so I could get to the next gig with Jason. He's like, you don't understand. The guy worked so hard. He was in so many bands. It was crazy.
I guess there was a time, but maybe, yeah, I guess. But I mean, at the end of the day, it was great, a great way to get exposure. You go to NAMM and they started having them at NAMM, or like they have them in LA right before NAMM. And it used to be you'd go and you'd run into these guys, and they were, say, Ludwig artists or something, and they'd be like, oh, hey, cool, how are you? And then once you got to play in front of these guys, it was a whole different dialogue. You would have these guys suddenly, you'd be in an elevator, or you'd be at a signing at NAMM, and now they knew who you were. So it was a great way for me to get exposure. And honestly, Marilyn Manson, he basically checked out. Part of what got me in the audition was a Bonzo Bash video. That's one of the
No
things
way.
that Manson said, all right, well, you're this guy. So it actually served a multi-purpose, exposure, as well as like a calling card.
Was Rocco Reedy the stage manager of Manson when you were on Manson?
No, I don't know
Okay.
him.
So I
No.
got a Rocco Reedy question for you guys. This guy is a big stage manager. He's a great guy. He's an old, one of the older roadies, hopefully. But the question he had me ask, and it was great. I asked Davey Johnstone it, and he had a killer answer. But who's the most interesting guy or the most interesting person you guys have met who's not a rock star?
Oh boy.
Huh.
Yeah, that's a oof.
It's a good one. So Davies was Princess Margaret, and the story was really, really good. But who's the most interesting?
Well, I got to meet Regis Philbin, and talk about a guy that's just pure showbiz. And I almost missed the Regis and Kelly show when I played on it, which was really frightening. I got hung up in the Marriott Marquis elevator system and
Oh
missed, I missed the van. And I was freaking out. And so they're on the way, and I'm like having to try to get a cab. Finally got there. And so we met Regis, and he was like, can I get you a vodka? And this is like early, early in the morning. And so,
no.
but talk about a guy that can tell stories,
Oh,
it was pretty fun. I just pulled that out, Sutter. What do you got?
I mean, for me, it's really tough, and I don't know. This dude is kind of a rock star, but like somehow by accident, actually, I met waiting for a bathroom after a show was Henry Diltz, the photographer who shot like Morrison Hotel, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash on the Couch, and
Oh, yeah.
countless other great. And Henry, I met him literally waiting at a bathroom at a restaurant in Hollywood after a Morrison Hotel, which is his gallery show. A bunch of photographers from Jim Marshall to Niels Lowsauer to you name it, Ross Halfen. And I happened to go to the after party restaurant with my date, and I'm waiting at the restroom, and Henry walks up and he's like, hey man, is this the bathroom line? And I was like, yeah. And I went on to like, tell him how I'm a big fan. And next thing by the time we're done, we've set up a photo shoot that he's going to shoot at my house. But the stuff that comes out of his mouth, is just, this dude is a photographer, but obviously he's been everywhere. And he's like a wizard of rock and roll. And, he's just one of those dudes who I'll be at some crazy party and I'll be talking to like this, top, who I met years ago, is now one of the top Playboy photographers, who's hip, maybe a few years older than me, and kind of tried and true. And we're hanging out at some private party for I forget the magazine, but it's a cool magazine at like one of the Getty's houses, in the hills. And we're hanging out, and I hear like, I'm talking to this guy, and all of a sudden I hear like, hey, Jason, and in like a full white suit, holding a glass of champagne, barefooted, off in the distance is Henry Diltz getting closer. And this like A-list photographer is just like holy shit, is that Henry Dilts like losing his mind? And Henry's just like, you know, and Henry's 82 and still like the life of the party. He's still like the guy who'll stay latest at the bar. He'll have as many drinks as you do. Not that he's a big drinker, but like the dude is still like nonstop, and every word out of his mouth is fantastic. So I guess I would have to say that guy, because I don't think he's actually could be considered a rock star, even though he was in a folk band back in the 60s. I think that's
rock affiliated.
Yeah, rock exactly. Affiliated. I mean, bona fide, you know,
yeah,
to the top level, you know.
I did get asked to sit at a table with Hugh Hefner. That was pretty cool.
That's neat. What'd you guys talk about?
Not much. I was shocked.
Yeah. He's like, can you pass the pineapple juice? I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably bad.
That's a Mardi Gras. Like, I regret not getting to go to that house or get to do that hang, because I was around and I could have, you know, I could have done it, but I was so busy. I got invited to like 3 or 4 of those, you know, the midsummer nights thing, you know, and I had an invite and I was in like Spain, and I, you know, this was 2007. He was still kicking. Those parties were still going off. I had an in, and every time I got an invite, I was just miles away. And it's heartbreaking because I love that Hollywood ethos and what he brought to the table, yeah. And all that vibe and all those great old photos of like James Caan and, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or whatever shit, you know, I love that. And I thought, God, wouldn't it be cool to make one of those parties while this cat is still around? And I never got to do that. You know, it's just fascinating.
Well, the house was bought by some Greek billionaire and for his son. And
I believe it.
And they've been ripping the place apart. They renovated the whole thing.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, somebody should have bought that place and not changed a thing.
Well, that was the deal. He didn't want anything changed. He liked, I think it was all early 80s, and he wanted it that way. He didn't want anything updated. He liked it.
Yeah.
It might have been 70s.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that got away. I just so wish I could have gone and like experienced that vibe of the Playboy Mansion. You know, what a Hollywood, you know, legend.
It was interesting, Sutter. I went to a Mardi Gras party there, and you can't drive. You have to catch a shuttle somewhere on Wilshire.
I believe it.
And they shuttle you in like you're not allowed to know where it's at. And it's pretty disorienting. And then you get there and you pull up to the little, you know, circular roundabout thing. And it's just, it's intense. They got the zoo and the grotto and it's something else.
Dude, I'm jealous. I'm just so
Were your guys' parents musicians, or how did you guys get into the fold, and were they happy that you got into music, or did it take a long time to be happy? Or
I got an answer for that. Yeah, actually how I discovered drums in the first place was, I was sneaking around in my dad's closet looking for his rifle because he had left the house, and I thought, I know he's got the gun in there somewhere and I just want to see it. You know, I had no devious plans, but I just wanted to check it out. And so I found it, I unzipped it, and I'm like, there it is, and I zipped it back up. And meanwhile, somehow I was, you know, messing around, and this pair of drumsticks literally fell out of the top shelf of his closet.
Wow.
And when he got home, I said, you know, and there was a little wooden Ludwig practice pad up there as well. And when he got home,
they signed by Jason Sutter? They were like Jason Sutter drumsticks.
Yeah, it's a signature, 1964 Sutter practice. Do you remember those, Sutter? The wood platform. I mean, these are before our time.
Yeah.
And so he got home and I asked him, I said, Dad, what are these? And he was a drummer in junior high for a short period of time. He's like, where did you find those? And I said, in your closet. And he's like, really? He showed me how to hold traditional grip. That's how he played. And that stuck with me, actually. That's why I play traditional a lot of the time.
That's a cool story. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, mine was different, and it does kind of tie in with fine art, which we talked about before we started this thing. My dad was a professor at a college in called Potsdam State, a state university college, and had a huge art collection. Those state university colleges have incredible art collections. Incredible
what
galleries.
What did he teach, a professor of art or?
Fine art. Yeah. So he taught drawing, sculpture, you know, there was a foundry, you could pour, you know, cast bronze, welding, you know, everything, you know, it was a huge foundry, really. Bell Brass. I could have actually done that. He works in bronze. So, but okay. I actually meant tried to, I mentioned the idea of pouring a brass and we talked about it, you know, but anyway, long story short is there was a music school there called Crane School of Music. And my dad was friends with the drum teacher there. His name was James Peterzak, who ended up becoming like, you know, he's still teaching there amazingly in his 70s and is like a legend educator, taught Dave Weckl, Vinnie Colaiuta, and numerous other great, great drummers at young ages, you know. And he's a famous educator for having these great hands, and he's taught hundreds of, you know, music educators who went to that Crane School of Music. And so my Peterzak was a fan of art. This is the, you know, probably late 70s. And my dad agreed to trade him a big drawing of a nude for drum lessons for me. And so around by the time I was like 8 or 9, I was studying with Jim Peterzak, who's like, you know, this legend. And that's so that my dad was so my basically my tutelage was born from fine art, which is kind of fascinating. Right. And Peterzak still has that piece in his house, which is pretty heavy.
Is it a picture of you as a baby?
No. It was probably big boobs and some woman, or I don't know. It was probably
go figure.
But drawing. It was that era where that stuff was finally nudes were accessible. But anyway, that's how I got drum lessons, and that's how I kind of got started. I grew up in a small town, and my dad also sold a sculpture, another one here that his son. Sold a sculpture to one of the biggest publishers in music ever, Sandy Feldstein, who owned Alfred Publishing. It's massive.
That's right.
He's also a famous percussionist as well. He was in one of the first percussion ensembles. And his son, David, does a spitting image of Chris Cornell. And we did a tribute for Chris Cornell, and that's where I met him. And it was David Feldstein. And then he's a huge producer, publisher. And he owns one of the same sculptures I have that his father bought from my dad. And with that came flooding of drum books once Sandy found out when I was like 9, I couldn't read any of this stuff. But so it was all kind of like my father was extremely supportive and would he would go to work, teach, come home, eat dinner, and then take a nap for like an hour and then go back to work on his art at night to his foundry. And while he was so dedicated to me being a good student, because he was like a nuts art student, and because of this connection with the art, that he would literally have me practice while he was taking a nap in the same room. And the deal was when he woke up, I still needed to be practicing. So he would sleep through me practicing. Yeah, it was pretty nuts, kind of a... So yeah, my parents were super supportive, and I grew up in a small town, a college town, where I was gigging for money by the time I was like 13, you know, working steadily, playing these college events because there was just so much live music and there wasn't enough drummers to do it. So it was great. I lucked out. And Peterzak is still a dear friend of mine, will text me, you know, all the time. And you know, he's a legend. So yeah, I lucked out. Thanks to my parents, for sure.
I had Ron Wixo on, and he was telling me about auditioning for Cher and stuff. And the story was, it was really funny. But did you have to audition for Cher?
Well, no, yes and no. Ironically, the Cher thing came from me doing, I was doing a European drum clinic for Ludwig for about a month all over Europe. And I was at this, I did a German festival where I demoed all these Ludwig snare drums. And one of the demo parts was I was playing brushes. And so I did like a brush demo to a jazz tune, and that they posted that. And Mark Schulman, who had been playing with Cher for the last like 12 or 13 years, amazing drummer, saw that. And because he saw that, he knew that I could rock. He knew I could hit hard. He knew that he'd worked with Pink, which is same management, for years. And finally they were having a conflict where Pink was going to be working and Cher at the same time. And so he was going to have to find somebody for the Cher gig and hand it off probably for good. And so he saw me, he knew he needed someone for Cher who could hit really hard, but could also play very softly. And he knew I could rock. So when he saw this brush thing, he said, oh my God, this dude could do those levels. So he called me based on that. And that's how that gig happened. So yes and no, but I would never have thought, again, a brush thing or something like that would have led me to the Cher thing. But to be fair, he's right. That Cher gig is literally like this level and this level. And you really got to be able to cover all of that. It's one of the hardest gigs I've ever done. So, you know, so that was But, you know, you show up. And then I did have another audition, which is interesting. And this is something, I don't know. It was kind of a Zen weird kind of thing. But I had met with Mark. He said, you know, this is in November. He said, we're starting to rehearse after NAMM at SIR in Hollywood. You should come down and meet the music director. Because Mark was going to do like the first up through July. And then he would need a sub. And I was working with Dee Snider. I was booked with Dee Snider on a solo record doing all European, a big European tour. So it worked out perfect. And he said, you know, we should have a coffee. You should come down and meet these guys. Well, I had never heard back from him, you know, because Mark was busy. They're in rehearsals at SIR for like a month. And I reached out and said, hey, man, can I come down and have that coffee? Can we meet up and have that coffee? I'd love to keep this going. And it's an interesting thing for young players or any players. When someone says like they want you to do the gig, they want you to want the gig too. They're you know, they could maybe throw that line out, but you got to grab it and start reeling them in too. There's a responsibility. If I meet some young player and I say, hey, you sound great, I could use, you know, you should call me. I have a gig. If they never call me because they think they're being cool by not calling me and not bothering me, then they'll never get the gig because I need them to show me that they really want that gig. Yeah. And so this was kind of like one of those mental tests where I called Mark and he was like, oh, dude, great. Why don't you come down? We'll have coffee at the rehearsal. And I went down and the amazing bass player, Eva Gardner, who's now out with Mars Volta, who's in the original Mars Volta, has played with Pink and Cher with Mark for all these gigs. She and I are dear friends and she's on the gig. We go hiking all the time. We hang out all the time. She's on the gig at the rehearsal and there's a music director there and then the rest of the band. And I show up. I meet the drum tech. I meet, you know, I see Mark. They give me headphones. I can watch the whole show. We have coffee. I start meeting him. I go up to Eva to talk to her. And she's giving me like the cold, like, yeah, dude, cool. Short answer. Kind of cut me off. And I realized this was a test. She didn't want to talk to me. She's like, talk to those guys because you're auditioning right now, dude, without playing a note. The fact that I showed up to them was very impressive. The fact that I called Mark was like, hey, man, you know, it was like, the Willy Wonka moment where like I didn't take the chocolate, you know, whatever. It was like that I had made the effort to come down there and then I met with these guys without having to hit a note. That got me the gig. So there was a follow-up audition that I didn't realize. I had to prove that I was serious about this job. And Eva being kind of like the cold, you know, shoulder was saying, don't talk to me, brother. I know you. I already told him you can play. Go talk to them. So sometimes you're auditioning without even knowing it. And sometimes no one's going to give you these cues. You need to like, you need to follow up. And if you don't, then you weren't the guy for the job. So it's a very.
Either one of you guys have any funny ones that backfired? They did not go well.
I have hundreds.
Hundreds.
Oh, I've got one.
What do you got?
My first audition in Nashville was with Gary Allen. And I had no idea that the lead singers oftentimes don't even show up. And I worked so hard on this, you know, Sutter, like the obsessive kind of thing, like every hi-hat opening, every ghost note, Chad Cromwell played on the records. And I really liked the songs too. I was pumped. So I go in and there's no vocalist, there's no nothing. And at the time, Gary Allen was People Magazine's top 50 beautiful people in the world or whatever. He was on that list. And so they had a microphone stand at the front of the stage at SIR. They had the spread open to his page. And while I was auditioning, they had BB guns inside of SIR shooting his picture while I was playing. And I didn't get the gig. But I thought that was pretty bizarre. They're taking target practice at their singer who's not there and not paying attention to me at all. So,
yeah, it's funny how things have changed so much from that era of when you were auditioning. Then Nashville is an entirely different world. That's a whole other podcast, right? Yeah. It's like it was back then. It was like a little tight knit scene, and now the doors have been blown off that, you know. It's a whole different world, you know. It's pretty fascinating. But I mean, I have every other audition was a you know, there are so many. But I remember one where I was trying to get an audition. I heard that Morrissey, this is probably almost 20 years ago, Morrissey was auditioning for drummers, and an old drummer who played with him was Dean Butterworth. This is the story of like the craziness you go through, at least that I went through, where you have a spark and then you have to take that spark and try to turn it into a fire. And it's solely your responsibility. And hopefully along the way, somebody, you know, gives you some kindling, you know. But I had played with a band called American Hi-Fi, and we toured with Good Charlotte that Dean was now playing with, okay, in 2005 on a festival. We met, we hit it off. I didn't get his number, and I was trying to find Dean Butterworth, and I was calling around. I called a guy named Mitch Marine, who plays with Dwight Yoakam, has for a long time. But before that, he played with Smash Mouth for a while, for years. And he said, you know what, I don't have a connection for this Morrissey audition, but Smash Mouth is going to be looking for a drummer. I'm leaving to go play with Dwight. I'll give them your number, and you know, they're holding a big cattle call audition. Fast forward, I finally get in touch with someone who knows. I'm playing with the Rembrandts, by the way, right now. So I'm on tour with the Rembrandts in 2005, right after American Hi-Fi. They're doing their like post Friends tour of Casinos that went horribly wrong, which is a whole other story. So long story short is I get the audition with Morrissey, but I'm in an airport and I have to play three songs, and one of them's to a track, and they're going to videotape it and send it to Morrissey. At the time, I'm scruffy, I have long hair. Both those things don't work with Morrissey, which I don't know about at the time, but you got to be clean cut, you got to have short hair. And I go into the audition and I'm pumped. I crammed to get this together. And because they know that I got the call like the day before I landed. So I only had one day to prepare. The bass player is a guy who went to North Texas. And we go through this song with this guy, Boz, who was longtime Morrissey MD. We run through the tune, they're videotaping, we play through these songs, and it is electric. I'm the first guy to show up for the day, and it is like, dude, slam the sticks down, I got this gig. And Boz, the MD, is just like, done, you know, dude, killer. And he looks over at the bass player, and he's like, right, then we're good. And he's like, I didn't record it. He's like, I didn't record it. I was just broing him out. I thought I'd give him a chance to run it through once, because I know he just got the music. And it was just like the air just went out of the room. Like it was like, just, it was like, you've got, like everyone was deflated, and we ran this stuff again and recorded it. And it was just nothing like the energy it was the first time. Oh. And obviously that's how the gig went. And this dude thought he was growing me out. And in fact, that energy was just, you know, it was over. Everyone was deflated. And it was like, just running it like, it was like a sad sack, you know. So I've had countless auditions where things like that happen, where you had no control over it, and it worked against you, you know. But I think any of those experiences only make you better at auditioning and getting over those kind of losses. I don't know what you think about that, Ryan, but to me it feels like the auditions you don't get, if you leave and you can you can learn from them, then it was still a great audition, you know.
Absolutely.
Just, you know,
Ryan, was Paul Rodgers a fan of Collective Soul?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I got asked to play with him during while I was with Collective Soul. And so he got the home DVD that I played on with the 120-piece youth orchestra. And that, I think, tipped him over the edge. But it's actually a very interesting story how that came to pass.
Okay.
You want to hear it?
Oh, Jason, you got time?
I'm good.
All right.
I'm good. By the way, I'm a huge Paul Rodgers fan. And I remember, Ryan, when you got that gig and we were hanging, I just gotten the Cornell gig. And I remember you came over, you had a DVD, you know, that was like not out yet. And I remember you playing it for me. I was like, it was just like so shit hot. It was so good. I was just like, dude, it was so killer. I was just like, God, what a great gig. Like, I love Bad Company and Free. So anyway, I remember this time, you know, I remember.
Yeah. Well, the very quick version of the story is I actually was, I grew up on Bad Company like anybody else, but I was in college working concert security at the Smirnoff Amphitheater in Dallas. Nice. I saw Paul Rodgers live, and this weird little thing happened to me. I was just like, first of all, I was blown away. Second of all, I was like, I'm going to play for him. It was a weird little thing that happened. So then after I got out of school, I started making promo packs and calling every single management company on the planet. And I would go to the post office with stacks of these things and mail them out. And literally the only response that I got was from Paul Rodgers' manager, because my bio said that I came from the Pacific Northwest, which is not entirely true. I'm from Anaheim, California. But he's lived in Bellingham, Washington. And he goes, oh, you're from Washington State as well? Let's stay in touch. So I would send him a CD or anything that happened in my career. I would send him something maybe once a year. This went on for like probably a good 8 or 9 years. And then I got the gig with Collective Soul. He knew about that. And I literally got a phone call right before we were going to go on a 3 or 4 month hiatus. And he said, "Hey, I see you're playing in Sacramento. Can I come to the show?" So he came to the show, hung out with everybody. I decided to move from Nashville to LA. I'm in the U-Haul driving all the way across the country. And I get a call saying, "Hey, can you be in Seattle for rehearsals in 2 weeks?" And so I said, "Yes." So that's the short version of the story.
Wow, I never knew that story. It's fascinating. I never knew about that.
It's the only promo pack. I literally sent out hundreds of these things, and it's the only one that kind of came to fruition.
That's
good. Wouldn't have worked.
I remember one little story I remember once accidentally I called Ozzy Osbourne's management company, and actually Sharon answered.
Wow.
And I said, "Hi, my name is Ryan. I'm a drummer from Texas." And she goes, "Are you fucking kidding me?" And hang up the phone.
Wow. That's great, man.
Yeah.
You're lucky she didn't sue you or try to, like,
that's
have a press legal, you know, legal.
I know. I'm very fortunate.
Wow.
That's really good. All right. So a lot of my friends have little kids, and my friend's daughter was in fifth grade when I started this, and she had a couple girlfriends over, and they were into the podcast idea. And she's like, she was like very serious, which so she goes, "You need to ask everyone who comes on, when did they first feel famous?" And so I ask each of you guys, when did you first feel famous? What event? If fame is not something you choose, a road you want to go down and answering the question, whatever, when was there a moment in your career that was pivotal, that changed things, made you feel good about yourself?
Oh, for that
question I have, by the way.
I mean, for me, it was, I bought a home in Nashville, a rental property in East Nashville, which then was like a total garbage can. East Nashville in 2007, summer of 2007 was a garbage can. It was like, get out of your car. And now it's like the streets are paved with gold, and literally the neighbor, I sold that house, but the house next to it was like the Cage the Elephant singer. And next to the other side is one of the biggest songwriters in the world, who plays with Steven Tyler, Rebecca Lynn Howard. And then next to me on the other side was Taylor Swift's guitarist. You know, that's who lived there when I sold. But when I bought it, it was garbage. And I had this property for years, and it was kind of a slumlord until it kind of caught up to be a really nice area, but I long-term rented. And I went back to renovate the property and turn it into an Airbnb years later. And I had been gigging a lot, and I showed up in Nashville, and it blew my mind that everywhere I went, I'm lucky to have some of the best friends and some of the coolest drummers, and just like I get to go hang with these. There's a whole scene there of just the coolest dudes. And when I show up, it's like, "Oh, we got a dinner set up, dude. We go to, you know, a Mexican restaurant. There are 20 of the coolest drummers hanging out." And I can say I honestly know them, and I love them dearly. And that they let me into this world is huge. But to be fair, I did own houses there way before they even got to Nashville, which is pretty funny. But so these dudes, I'm there, I'm renovating a house. So I'm there for about 3 weeks or whatever, overseeing these contractors. And everywhere I would go, I'd just be walking down the street, and the dude be like, "Dude, huge fan." You know, like, "What the, me?" You know, or I'd be like eating a coffee, and the guy come, "Dude, just wanted to say, you know, and it was everywhere. Every show I attended, like afterwards, there were like, I would be like, four or five dudes would walk up. And I remember one time, which was the best, I was with one of my dearest friends, Kevin Murphy, and we went to town. He was like, "Oh, you got to try this burger at this place. It's amazing. We got to go." And it was a little off the beaten path near Music Row, but like off Broadway or whatever. We're sitting there, and I've been doing this stuff for a while now. This is, you know, later. I'd, you know, probably own this house for 10 years. And we're sitting there, we're eating, and I'm sitting there with Murphy, and it's just me and him. We're having a burger, and it's kind of like later, after, you know, it's probably like 10 o'clock. And I look over, and there's another kind of bar scene there. And there's like a young guy there, and he's got like four like smoking girls around him. And I'm like, Murphy and I are joking. I was like, "I remember that, man. I remember when you were young, and you were like, had all the girls, and, you know, we're like, yeah, dude, yeah, that dude, yep." Well, you know, we were there, you know, and we're eating, and the guy finally gets up, and, you know, and he gets up with these girls, and they're walking by our thing, and right as he gets up to us, he turns and goes, "Dudes, I'm the hugest fan. I've been freaking out over there. I just had to say, like," and I looked at him, and I was like, "What is going on?" He's like, "You're in Nashville, dude." He's like, "In LA, nobody acknowledges that. Nobody cares." And it's true in LA, if you don't know this already, but you could be sitting next to George Clooney at the end of the bar, and no one's going to bother George Clooney. No one. He's just sitting there. It's not probably not. No one can say anything to him at the right bar. And that's how LA is. He said in Nashville, everyone is paying attention to music. Everyone, whether you live here or in LA or in New York or anywhere, the people in Nashville, this is a music city. They know who you are. They're hungry. They're paying attention. They're listening. And it was like a revelation, but that I really did feel like the most famous ever. You know, I mean, that is like, it's one thing if you're in a rehearsal studio and there's a young guy and he's like, hey, I went to Berkeley. I listened to your podcast or whatever. So that was a moment. And that
did
is.
Did you take his girls?
Yeah. We left with like two chicks on each arm. We're like, loser. Peeled out.
The four pack.
We didn't. But the girls were like, totally like, ooh, like we were like a big deal. It was just so surreal to be like, you know, we're envying this guy, just kind of joking. And then it turns out this dude is actually envying.
Yeah, that's cool. Know,
our, yeah. So it was cute, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah.
That was a moment of like, what is going on? You know? So yeah, it was surreal.
What do you got?
I got two part answer to that. I think that I got to actually play with my favorite band, which is Collective Soul, and got to be a band member. And I was in the studio with them for about a year and a half before I ever got to go out on the road. And I never even knew that would be possible. And so for some time I was a sub on the road, playing the former drummer's equipment, everything. Couldn't even bring my own drum set out there. And then at some point I was allowed to go to the meet and greets and I was allowed to interface with the fans and the audience. And so I was feeling pretty big. And we're at a show in Athens, Georgia, and it's this huge college town and it's just people everywhere. It's mayhem. And Ed looks at me and he goes, go outside and some autographs. And I'm like, really? Okay. You know, I'm 25 years old at this point, something like that, 26. So I opened the door to the bus and I'm thinking, and I've got a tiny solo cup in my hand and it's got literally one sip of beer in it. And so I go out and I'm feeling like on top of the world. I'm signing this, signing that. And I'm just like, yeah. Next thing I know, a bicycle cop comes up and I literally get accosted by this guy, takes my beer away, gives me a ticket, threatens to arrest me in front of all these fans that are asking for my autograph. And I literally had to go back and show up in front of a court and like, I got it dismissed, but it was pretty embarrassing.
Dude, that's rock and roll, man. That's, I would have just been like, dude, like you'd be signing so many more autographs after that, right? Like, oh, he's the dude who gets arrested, man.
He took my sip of beer away. I'm just like, really?
That's so Keith Moon. 90s.
My second part to that answer would be, I think for me, when I played Royal Albert Hall with Paul Rodgers, and we literally had Roger Taylor walking down the hallway, Brian May of Queen, we had Roger Fisher from Heart, Howard Leese from Heart, playing with, and we had Robert Plant in the audience. Rumors were that Jimmy Page was there in the audience. And so I'm like, I'm literally playing for Led Zeppelin and Queen and Heart. And that was frightening. it was something else.
Those moments are pretty surreal, like playing with Cornell.
It was surreal.
Like Jimmy Page is at the show, you know, and we're playing the Astoria, which I don't even think is there anymore. And there's a balcony, and Jimmy, it was when Jimmy first came out with like the white mane of hair, like it was like 2007. And he came out and he sat at the very edge, and there was one white light in the balcony only for like people to kind of go up that to the side. And he was in the end seat. And so literally the only person we can see in this venue is Jimmy Page. From like up above, like he's like,
oh,
like,
wow.
Like he's like floating above us, you know, like Nathan. Watching us, you know? And I just remember thinking like, I've got to play so well tonight.
Yeah.
Because this dude has played so well for me his whole life, you know?
Yeah.
It was such a moment. It wasn't nerve wracking, but it was a moment. But I remember another cool time meeting like someone like that playing the OC Fair, and Clem Burke from Blondie came with a buddy of mine.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
He was like, you know, who's my idol growing up? You know, I just loved his style. Still do. He's, he lives down the street and is a dear friend, and just still inspired by him. I go see Blondie whenever I can. And he showed up. I'd never met him. And he showed up and he's sitting on the side of the stage watching. And afterwards, he's a massive like Anglophile. He loves like England. Is that right? Anglophile? Anyway, he loves England. He's obsessed with England and the British movement and the Who and the 60s, and just obsessed. You know, his dressing room before every show is just filled with British, you know, Union Jacks and posters of the Who. And so anyway, he subscribes to this European drum magazine, I guess. And I had just done a feature. And so not only do I meet Clem Burke after the show, but he says, hey, you're in this magazine. They don't publish this over here. So here, and it was like, and I probably never would have gotten this magazine if it weren't for Clem Burke. So it's like, it was just like my brain was just kind of like melting, you know, the reality of like, you know, Clem Burke handing me this British drum magazine that I'm in, that he's, you know, it was just like, it was surreal. It was really an incredible, you know, moment. So that was one of the first times where you're playing for your peers and you're like, holy shit, you know, this is happening. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Do you think Clem considers himself a Ramon?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. He's not just a Ramon. He's a Ramon. He's a go-go. He's been in all that those worlds, and he deserves, you know, he deserves to be knighted by all those amazing new wave punk rock icons, no question. Because, you know, if you really read those history books, I'm obsessed with reading those, any old punk books. You know, I got to play with the New York Dolls, like, you know, getting to do that. Like I do deep dives whenever I'm playing with an artist and read everything. And Clem was everywhere, man. That dude was everywhere. You know, he's like a Joan Jett was the same thing, like, or obviously Chrissy Hynde. They're going back and forth from England and they're bringing this culture and going, you know, blowing it, you know, everywhere. Like they were bringing that punk rock, new wave punk ethos from England in truckloads, just in their minds, in their clothing. They brought that to New York City. You know, they brought that to LA. So Clem, Joan Jett, there's a whole sea of those people who were, obviously Chrissy Hynde, you know, in spades, were bringing that British movement to America, which then bounced back and kind of, you know, they were catalysts for that. So yes, he definitely deserves one of the rings, you know, or whatever. He's royalty from that. Yeah. He is what? Is it the seventh Ramon, or I don't know how many guys have been Ramones, but he's one of them.
I think, he's the last one, right?
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. What do you got, Ryan? Sorry, I interrupt you.
Oh, no, I forgot at this point. But that's a great answer, Sutter. I was going to say, I think a pretty surreal moment that both of us took part in was, you know, many years at going to NAMM convention and signing autographs on behalf of the Ludwig Drum Company and even the Paiste Cymbals Company and being standing next to Jason Bonham and standing next to Alan White and just, you know, standing in front of like Neil Peart's drum set back when he was with Ludwig. And yeah, I mean, those are pretty special moments.
Bunny Carlos from Cheap Trick, you know, all these famous legendary, I mean, I met Nick Mason at a Paiste booth at the London Drum Show once.
He's in LA tonight. He's in LA tonight. He's doing a show here tonight.
You're kidding. Yeah.
He only plays the early stuff.
He was the sweetest guy. And I guess he gets on a tube in London and doesn't miss a London drum show and gets on a tube alone and comes down and shows up and says hi at the Paiste booth and checks some dudes out. Nobody bothers him. It's just like, he was just a regular bloke, you know? And it was just, what is going on? Like, this dude is so heavy on so many levels, you know? Not to mention the, you know, as a drummer, but, you know, the guy is so multifaceted and fascinating character. So just that stuff is always amazing, meeting those people. Like, you know, Bunny Carlos was one of my biggest fans in the world from Cheap Trick, you know, my first drum idol who used Ludwig drums, Ryan, you know? And I remember I got asked to do Bunny Carlos shows you his famous drum collection, like from the 20s on from Ludwig. He is the most extensive. And so it was like, I was going to do a clinic there or do like a demo thing for Ludwig. And then Bunny was going to give me a tour, and it's on YouTube, I think, which is amazing. It was the first time he'd ever let anybody in with a camera into his like little man cave.
Oh, I remember that. You tell me. Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, I want to tell this guy, but I got to be careful about telling it. You know, you got to be careful telling someone that you're like their drum idol, you know, because there are certain guys that you just know probably got sick of it. You know, Neil Peart, obviously from Rush, doesn't want to talk drums, you know, yet he's very vocal about that, you know. And Bunny is a tricky guy. Your Bunny, if you get him on the wrong day, he could, you know, he could just be like, yeah, I don't want to talk about that. And so we're hanging out. And finally, at one point, I said, hey, you know, I got to pee, is there a bathroom here? He's like, you know, we can just go outside. I got to pee too. So we went out and he has a big barn and I'm pissing next to Bunny Carmen. And I literally looked over and I said, hey man, it was just me and him. Finally, it was all like no camera crew, no Ludwig reps. And we're peeing. And I looked over and I just went, I just got to say, dude, you're my first drum idol. You're my biggest fan. So I'm telling Bunny Carlos this while we both have our dicks in our hands. It was like, I don't know. Why not? You know what I mean? You know, what's the worst that could happen? He was really sweet. And it was, I feel like I could call him a friend. And it was one of those moments where you just go like, wow, And so I get what you're saying with the cymbals, the drums, like we worship those.
I just picture you there with your willy in your hand and all of a sudden wind hits and you're like, oh, sorry about that.
Sorry about those shoes, Bunny. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm still a fan.
But yeah, those moments are extremely surreal where you get to meet the dudes who literally were the wind beneath your wings and why you play the drums you play and why that's just, to me, that's just such a, I mean, obviously it's just a byproduct. The music is what it's all about, but to get to be around these guys. We were talking earlier,
that was like what Robert DeLeo, they were to me, man. They treated me like a little brother because I was so young. I was 21 or whatever, and I was so innocent. Well, and those guys, that were to me when I got in good graces and I felt like I was part of their little crew.
And those guys are the most gracious I've ever met. And they also are the biggest dorks when it comes to, they appreciate Joe Perry. They appreciate Gene Simmons. They appreciate the guys who came before them so much, and obviously those guys then in turn around and say, hey, we are huge fans because look what you did with what we, where we started. You guys are the ones who are taking this to a whole other level, I'm trying to think.
One of the common ones a lot is they start removing your drums. I hear that all the time.
That was my boss. He started removing my drums while I was playing, and then smashing them with like he was like trying to literally destroy, literally destroy them. So that was an every night occurrence with Manson, where literally we had to like, I had the bass drum set up where the pedal during the encore, the tech would have to unscrew the bass drum pedal because if Manson tried to grab the bass drum and smash it and couldn't get it, then he was going to smash everything. So you had to make it easy for him to get the satisfaction of smashing the bass drum. So we had to make it so he could just grab it by the end. And yeah,
it's like where you have that meal and you leave a little bit off for the flies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so it was basically just like, it was a chaos every night. So yeah, it was like a prank every night, pretty much. Yeah.
Do you have any ones, Ryan, of stuff?
I've got a prank that we did within our own band that went really wrong.
Okay.
And actually it's all on videotape. Our ex, one of our crew guys has it and I'd like to find him actually. But basically it was kind of towards the end of the tour and Sutter knows this, on a tour bus, the middle section where the bunks are is completely a sacred space. It is off limits, And so we were going to break that rule one night with our front of house guy, Jack. And he
what
was
band
a very,
is this? Your band?
This is with Collective Soul.
Oh, okay.
And so, after the show, Dean and I had maybe a couple of cocktails. And so we thought we're going to go get Jack because he's a very serious dude and he's like never having fun and he's really intense. And so the tour is about to end. So let's really mess with them. So what we didn't know is that our tour manager, Robert, actually got on the phone with Jack and tipped him off and said, Dean and Ryan are coming after you. So we go into the bunk thing and he's in his bunk trying to rest like it, super early. And we start trying to poke the curtain, And next thing you know, this like sock foot flies out and he starts attacking us. And by the end of this attack, it got so brutal. That literally it broke Dean's ribs.
Oh, shit.
He hit me in the head so hard, it knocked me to the ground, knocked me out for a minute. And so, that was a bunk attack where we learned a lesson. Don't do that because he literally kicked our ass and it was terrible. And Ed's wife watched the whole thing and she was just mortified. It was pathetic, man. The guy kicked
What was this guy's gig? What was he on the crew?
He was front of house engineer.
Oh, okay. Tough, man. All right.
We messed with the wrong guy.
Yeah, don't screw with the sound dudes.
With the Cher camp, which is pretty harmless, I mean, whatever. But the one of the background vocalists, Jody Katz, basically did Cher and kind of honed her skills with Trans-Siberian Orchestra for years, 10 years. And she basically came up with the, you know, self-proclaimed, she's the professional scarer. So Jody would spend her half of her day figuring out where she could hide and then jump out and scare the shit out of people, you know, and like hide. She was very tiny. So we would, and it would be orchestrated with like multiple camera angles. And it would be really, really like she'd be locked in a case for like a good 15 minutes. She was willing to like play, you know, where there's no way that girl could be in there. And then they open the wardrobe case and she jumps out and, you know, and then there's like four camera angles, you know, and we had this happen numerous times, just countless videos of like when somebody's getting on the bus and they walk by the bunk. And then she, you know, jumps out of the, you know, so it was in there. It's like, you know, just dying laughing moments. But I remember one other like kind of goofy whatever is Cornell. Chris Cornell was like a total rascal. He could really, you know, like it was hilarious. And he was always really, you know, he went through this. But anyway, we were in Oslo in Norway, and I don't know why me and the guitarist Pete decided that, you know, we needed to have like more flair on this tour, and so we went out and found black vests, and we kept playing these shows where, and so it was laughable, we both show up with our cool new outfits, you know, classic, and Cornell just died laughing when he walked in, and we had realized, me and the guitarist, that we had bought the same black vest. Right. Yeah. Like here we were trying to be like so cool, have our new like flair. Right. I mean, as a drummer, you know, Ryan, you really got like a scarf or a vest. That's all you got. Maybe a nice necklace, maybe wrist, you know, sweatbands. But otherwise, you know, you don't have an outfit. That's all you got. So that was such a big deal for us. So it was just hilarious that we both showed up with these vests. So we both wore these vests on stage, and Cornell would leave the stage after for the encore. The band would come up first and play. And we, by the end of all these shows, we were always shirtless. I don't know why that happened, but long story short is we come out all shirtless, and Cornell, you know, we do this big intro to like Cochise or something. I don't know. And Cornell runs out on stage and he's wearing my vest. And he comes up and he looks at me, and Pete are shirtless, and he looks at both of us and points at the vest like, haha, motherfuckers, you know, I'm stealing your shit. Just like the most hilarious like inside moment, you know. We just died laughing. We could barely this is another story that's just a side note, which I think is pretty hilarious. It's not really a prank, but it's just a classic story that you don't hear a lot. But there was a famous story that I've heard from a few different people where from the crew, where the Lou Gramm, you know, had his own solo career and was a, you know, kind of, you know, that was that time he had that like Midnight Blue hit, you know, post Foreigner, and there, you know, it's like Cocaine is at an all time high, and the band comes out and Lou Gramm has this leather jacket on, and he, they score like, you know, this giant bag of coke, and Lou is like, I'll take that, you know, and sticks it in his leather jacket, right? And the whole band is like, you know, we're, you know, I'm taking this, we're doing it after the show. So the whole band's like, you know, stoked to be, you know, have this pile of the giant bag of coke, and they go out on stage and, you know, getting into it, and he's rocking out, and at one point he's like rocking and he pulls his jacket off and throws it into the crowd in like a rock movement, and the entire band stops playing. They're just like mortified because that's it, you know? And it was just like, I love that story. And so the nickname for him after that, because of course they never got the jacket back, you know? And of course he had no idea what he was doing when he did it. And he was just trying to pull a rock move, and the band was just so mortified they stopped. So the rest of the tour, his nickname, instead of being Lou Gramm, his nickname was Lou's Grams. I love that story. It's just so classic drug decadence, you know. I have a pretty wild, interesting story that maybe people don't know about, but it's pretty fascinating when you're mentioning Flea. Is I I decided one day, just randomly, like, I would like to have a copy of Kiss Alive, the record cover. You know, it was a huge record for me. It was one of the first records I got when I was little. And it, you know, I'm still a fan of that era, Kiss. And I thought, I want a copy of that. And it was the famous Finn Costello. I don't know if you know him, but he took everything from punk to XTC to Rush. The guy was everywhere. He was an Irish photographer. He took everything, you know, but very unknown, very understated, quiet guy. But he took everything. And I reached out. I found him online. I don't know if he's still around, but he was living in some tiny town in Ireland. And I said, can I buy this photograph? And he said, wow, I don't really sell photographs normally. And I don't really have a way to print this up, but I think I can figure something out. And his, you know, his price was very reasonable. And he said, I don't own that photograph. And I don't think a lot of people realize that, like the Aussie with his hands up on volume 4, Kiss Alive, and you can go on and on, probably the Fleetwood Mac photo behind you, those photos are gone forever. The, you know, a lot of times the record label, if the photographer wasn't a Henry Diltz who kept his photo, photos get sold to the record label, and the record label then throw them away after they were done. And the negative never goes back to the photographer. And so they're gone forever. And interestingly, you know, Finn said that photo is gone. It was sold to the label. The label, Casablanca, folded, who knows, it's thrown away. It's gone. And so he sent me a bunch of proof sheets to pick the next photo before, after, you know, that shot was shot in Detroit in like 74 or something. And then on the back, there's the famous photo of those kids holding the banner. I don't know if you remember that, you know, there's two doofy kids holding a banner in, like, I think it's Cobo Hall or Cobo Arena in Detroit. Long story short is I had heard that, Flea, or not Flea, sorry, Chad, who was, you know, who was around 8 then, or 10, was a huge Kiss fan. And he had talked to his neighbor who worked at Cobo Hall and said, she said, if you write a letter when you send in your check for tickets saying you want front row seats, they'll give you as close to front row seats as they can. It wasn't like it is now. You didn't buy that. You just, whoever bought first got first seating, you know? And so he did. He wrote a little letter at 10 years old to see Kiss. Long story short, he's got the end seat like 4 rows back, right? And I had heard this story, and I remember thinking, I wonder if I'll see Chad Smith in these photos, because the irony is, in this photo, after they shot the front, when he went to shoot the back, he just hung out and he saw these guys walking with a banner towards the front, and he was trying to get the whole arena. And as they're walking closer, finally they stop, and that's where he got the photo. You see the negatives as they're walking, and if you look, there's a baby Chad Smith sitting in seat 4, just like sitting there looking. And I have the proof sheet of baby Chad Smith. As these guys with the banner are getting closer and closer, it's like this whole thing ties together. And I remember telling him that story because when I was in college at Miami, a bunch of our friends decided they were going to be Kiss at this huge costume party for the music school. And so me and a bass player secretly decided we were going to be the two dudes holding the banner. And we literally made the banner and like dressed like these two hippie dudes, if you don't know it. And I told that to Chad and he just died laughing, you know. But he was, you know, Chad's a collector of rock photography and memorabilia as well, so I'm sure he said he was going to try to reach out, because how cool would it be for him to get one of those photos from Finn?
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, Perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Roadie, it's now available through Amazon in paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show.